Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, and we're going into The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. And this is a remake of a film that I must admit I watched as a kid. I love this new remake. I really enjoyed it, recommended it to tons of people. And I'm joined on the line by two of our regulars to help discuss it, starting with you, Ty. How are you?
Doing very well, thank you.
Coming to us from Richmond, Virginia, I understand?
Indeed, my new home.
Excellent. Congratulations on that. You've joined the faculty there.
Indeed. I'm in the Communication Arts Department at Virginia Commonwealth University, where our friend Matt Wallen is also a professor.
Yes. And we obviously love educators, so it's glad that you're doing that. And I'm also joined by Jason Diamond from New York, I presume.
Oh, yes. Nice, chilly, cold New York.
Just back from Sundance.
Yes, 10 days in Park City where it was warmer and less snowier than New York City, which is hard to believe.
Really? When I was in Sundance, admittedly, a couple of years ago, it was super snowy there. Wasn't it snowy this year?
No. Huh. They have like almost no snow in the mountains, and it was like 37 degrees Fahrenheit during the day. Yeah.
Right. Well, obviously, I'm in Sydney, so it's incredibly hot and sunny. Earlier this week, I was sailing and literally swimming off the back of the yacht, so I was just having a great time. So sorry about that, guys, but warm and sunny and cocktail-y down my end of the world. So did you guys enjoy The Secret Life of Walter Mitty as much as I did? Ty, what did you think?
You know, I went primarily because we were going to be doing this show, and you know, I have mixed feelings about Ben Stiller. I think he's in certain roles he's extremely funny, but sometimes he just leaves me a little flat. But to my delight, I really enjoyed this film. I thought it was well written, well directed, visually exciting, and I laughed. I laughed out loud quite a few times, and that's you know, not always the case with comedies. It's certainly not always the case with me. So I found it to be, you know, exceptionally entertaining, I would say.
Yeah, I found it to be delightful rather than sort of slapstick laughing. I can, those sort of Ben Stillery type roles where you're cringing, I find those hard to watch. This was exactly not that. This was just a really, like engagingly interesting. And it had a killer soundtrack, Jason. I loved the soundtrack. I bought the album as soon as I could.
Yeah, the soundtrack was great. I did very much. I had only seen the trailer and it looked interesting. And on Christmas Day, my wife was sick, so I took my kid, my 7-year-old son, and we went. And he loved it, and I loved it, and I thought that it was super funny. Excuse me, but also, you know, very poignant and dramatic and in the right moments, which is very rare for a Ben Stiller movie. And I think to me, it seemed like he wanted to make a real movie. I'm not disparaging studio comedies specifically, but you know, they're a formula of sorts. And I rank this sort of more closer to his Permanent Midnight type films where he wants to stretch it a little bit. And I agree with Ty that it was incredibly visually engaging beyond most dramedies, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. Did anyone see the original Danny Kaye version that I was
I've not seen that.
I saw it like years ago. It was more pathetic than this, I guess, by the way I remember it.
Yeah, that's the way I was going to go back and actually look at it, because I think I saw it like in the summer when I you know, as a child, I spent summers at a northern Minnesota cabin where we only got one channel through a rabbit ear. So in those years, I watched every movie that was on because there was no alternative. And so I remember being kind of excited because it seemed kind of wacky and entertaining in a kind of unexpected way. But then I remember, at least my memory of it, it kind of let me down, and it seemed like the character was a kind of more of a bumbling character than the Ben Stiller character, who actually was quite brilliant, but his genius wasn't on display. And so it was more about the manifestation of his true self as opposed to this, you know, kind of you know, lesser version that he presented publicly. So I like that angle. I like that he wasn't really a dysfunctional person. He just didn't have you know, a voice, as it were.
Undeveloped.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah, I've got to say, I really liked Reality Bites, which is going back a few years now, just from the filmmaking point of view, not so much of the sort of Zoolander school. So because I had that overtone of also the original Walter Mitty, I was desperately worried about three quarters of the way through that as it started getting super interesting. And obviously, we're going to have tons of spoilers in this. So if you haven't seen the film, please stop now. But when it looked like he was going to sort of succeed, I thought, oh no, please don't make this one of those dream sequences that the whole of the last section of the film has been, you know, just a kind of a dream, and we're going to go back to him in a cubicle getting fired. And I rejoiced in the fact that they didn't go that way, that they didn't just make him pathetic, as it were, or rather Ben Stiller left him, discovering and growing.
Yeah. I thought it turned over pretty nicely stylistically from daydream to actual crazy stuff that was happening to him for real, that you were initially riding a line like, okay, is this, you know, is he swimming with a shark? Is that fake or what? And I like how they turned it over pretty fast at the turnover point was when he jumped on the helicopter. And that whole Major Tom sequence I thought was really good. The guy in the bar was super awesome. And it built really nicely and had really good momentum to get you out of the daydream style and into the real world style.
I don't think it was clever that they didn't just stop it dead in its tracks. Like, they still had that bird or flocking sequence where he sees her face, yeah, and sort of comes off the bike. So it did transition out rather than just being kind of a
right
one point in the...
When he gets the text and it shows up on the side of the mountain, was super cool too.
So let's talk about the visual effects. And anyone want to take a guess at how many effect shots there were in the film?
No. You know what? I was going to go through and try to think about which one, how many. And then I thought, well, I'm probably going to be wrong strictly because I thought the location stuff was so awesome. I couldn't... I was sometimes thinking, well, this has got to be a matte painting, but then suddenly I think, well, no, it's probably just a part of the world I'm not that familiar with.
It's Iceland.
Yeah. You know.
Jason, want to take a punt?
I'll say 750.
And you're spot on. It's 700.
Oh. Wow.
So the interesting thing about this film is, and I don't know how I'm going to articulate this probably because I don't think I even understand it myself. In thinking back on the film, I do think the visual effects contributed to the story. I thought they were pivotal to the story. But I kind of loved the film when we were out of the effect sequences because, you know, I guess when they were reality to him, I enjoyed that more. When he had drifted off, I kind of, oh no, he's drifted off. So I kind of was adversely against the earlier effect sequences. Now, of course, that meant I was positively for the latter effect sequences when he's, you know, finding snow leopards and doing things like this, which clearly did have a large effects component. But looking back, if I skip over the sort of invisible effects, sort of my least favorite part of the film maybe was the superhero stretch guy fight down the streets. That, you know, because it was so far from reality, it just... Like I loved when he got to Greenland and the other end of the film. Do you guys agree?
I think that, you know, I would say that you're on to something, but I don't know if it affected me the same way, because I think there was a certain pathetic quality to his daydreams in the beginning. Like, they were so out of control, sort of manifestations of the ego as superhero that they kind of functioned as kind of pathetic to me. Like, he didn't just save the dog, you know, it had to be from an exploding building and, you know, he made it a prosthetic leg. So he was definitely in search of, again, this persona, or in his real life, he was in search of something that through his imagination had to be so like over the top that it wasn't reasonable. It wasn't plausible. And really who could manifest that or actually want that? So it was this strange kind of hallucination that had to do with this overbearing, imaginative, you know, manifestation of self. And then as he went later and into the picture and his real life started to actually become quite extraordinary, the real life part that you're mentioning started to be more interesting than these kind of vaudevillian earlier sequences to me. So I kind of felt like the director was, you know, that Stiller was playing it as a kind of, yeah, it was exciting to watch them maybe go down the street on the skateboards and pull up the concrete and do these wild things. But it smacked of something that was so kind of ridiculous and sort of from an action film that it didn't have much bearing on a real person's life. And then
you also that other thing, right? That that I knew he was in a daydream, especially going down the street one. And so I just wanted to get back to reality because I wanted to get on with the story because I knew that wasn't going anywhere. But that's exactly what the character had to do in the film. I think reinforcing my dislike of it.
I mean, I can tell you from a broad generational marketing perspective, having my kid next to me and me, that he absolutely loved the superhero fight sequence, right? That was like, it's like, oh, you know, when they went down the street and did blah, 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 that was amazing. So it works on that level. But for me, the over-the-top nature of those things, to me, spoke to the reason why he felt so paralyzed in real life is because he thought that you had to do these incredibly overt and gigantic things to make an impression on anybody, that who could ever in their own mind satisfy that in the real world.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
I think the jump into the window at the beginning to save the dog was a terrific tool for the trailer. Like, it told you a lot about the story and would have got a lot of people to see a film, because the stuff that made me love the film wouldn't play well on a trailer. And so, you know, in a sense, there's this other aspect that I totally appreciate. They needed some stuff to be kind of big and wild to pull a crowd, to allow them to enjoy the rest. But Ty, I wanted to ask you one other thing before I forget about this. I love the title sequence montage into the narrative with the text and the way that the graphic sequence was done at the front. Did you like that?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I think to me, if I look at it from a like purely cinematic standpoint, there was a kind of falseness, like an artificiality that was a construct of his life, right? I mean, he's living in this world where he feels out of control. Everything is bigger than he is. He can't even get the dating service, you know, to run properly. He seems to be out of sync with his own identity and with the world, in a sense. And the person he admires is actually somebody who's just a super informed human, right? I mean, he's a photographer that just has a good eye and a lot of interest in doing great work. So he had a sense of that kind of person, but he certainly wasn't that person. And so in my mind, the credits in the beginning, like you were mentioning with the way they appear in buildings and stuff, it just kind of added that layer of synthetic kind of misplaced, ideas about identity and place and time. So I thought it was effective.
Jason, ask you specifically this about the cinematography. I thought that the framing in that title sequence was gorgeous. Like, there were some really nice wide angle, but without much curvature type shots that were very graphic.
Yeah, I kind of forgot about that till you just brought it up. Cause I saw it at Christmas time, here in this late December, but I do remember really liking I always like a good title treatment. And I remember probably one of the first ones that really stood out like that was the Panic Room titles. Unfortunately, the titles were maybe better than the film, but when the titles are really integrated into the style of the film, it's really when it gets me. And I really did like these very much. But like you were saying, Ty, I think the whole first half of the movie is basically based on his vicarious nature, right? As you were saying about the Sean, whatever his name was, the photographer character, the Sean Penn character, is that he, you know, he works in the cube, in the dark room, living vicariously through the negatives, even less vicariously through his daydreams, and I think that played really nicely into that transition, like I was saying before. Even though the original stuff, like you were saying, Mike, was a little over the top, I feel like that was the place where they felt like they could get their humor out, like the Benjamin Button gag. And that stuff was like, okay, we have to do a couple Ben Stillery moments. Let's do them as classy as we can without getting totally, you know, apeshit. And I think they were pretty successful.
Interestingly, it took 13 different vendors to get this film made. And it took a long time to get the film made. It took a long time to get this up off the ground. But yeah, those 700 shots were done by 13 different vendors. And we obviously want to sort of discuss that. So I guess moving away from the aesthetics and the narrative for a second, let's discuss just, because these are very isolated sequences. I mean, I think you could have 13 vendors because it is possible to say, hey, the superhero sequence is nothing like anything else in the film. It doesn't have to tie into anything else. It's no, you know, there's no, maybe a digital double, you know, you could share an asset, but, you know, you say, okay, well, I'm going to do, It's Not a Porpoise, Shark Attack, and it's very much the only kind of water sequence, shark attack sequence in the whole film. So, it did lend itself to those things. Benjamin Button, again, another good example. It's just like a really isolated bit. So can we hit on a couple of those and just get our opinions on them just from a purely, from these big effect sequences that are the ones that are obviously out of the film before we come to discussing later, I think, the more seamless stuff. So I guess start with you, Jason. You know, let's start, I guess, with that. You said your audience loved the superhero fight sequence down the streets. Do you think it technically delivered?
Yeah, I mean, I did have a Stretch Armstrong as a kid, so I did feel an affinity for that. But it was basically their Spider-Man rip, more or less. Yeah. I would think so. I wasn't expecting it, and so once he pushed him out the window, obviously, you know, he's in a daydream because he never stood up to Adam Scott's character ever until the very end. So anytime he did, you know, you were already, you knew it was heading somewhere. So I thought it worked really well. I think maybe there's some leeway on the side of the VFX houses for some of these gags, because they are, the audience is already clued into the fact that they're a fantasy. So I don't, you know, I'm not saying it wasn't realistic, but I think, you know, in their processes, maybe they had the ability to make choices they maybe wouldn't be able to make if they were having to do a super realistic, you know, Spider-Man thing or something where they really had to sell it as actually happening. So I think it sort of had a fun cartoony nature without being cartoonish.
It's funny that it had to be over the top in a genre where over the top is standard.
Right. And over the top has to be sold as real.
Yeah.
So I think I enjoyed that sequence because it's completely ridiculous. And the fact that they would have this massive superhero fight on the street with asphalt skateboards and Stretch Armstrong, you know, is the main device for who wins the fight. I think it was super fun and it worked really well for me personally.
Yeah, so it was shot on location. There's a lot of 2.5D projection stuff done and, of course, digital doubles. Ty, did you think it sold or did you think that it... Because for me, it was my least favorite sequence.
Well, I think that I think Jason's point is correct. I mean, it was crazy in a way that how realistic could it be to have, you know, two men, you know, zooming along the ground and pulling up this endless, you know, zipper of asphalt. Is it was sort of even in the genre of, like, you know, the X-Men or Spider-Man, I think it went beyond where those kinds of action sequences would go, because I think the suspension of disbelief and the kind of believability of the character's capacity is kind of always pruned and cared for by the director so as not to, you know, disrupt the fantasy too much, whereas this was just kind of nuts. And given that, I think that it was effective visually. I mean, I couldn't quarrel with it as far as what the absurd reality looked like. I thought it looked like good, well-done, absurd reality. But I think I was judging it in more of a vaudevillian, again, kind of manner. Interestingly, also, I probably got one of the biggest laughs for me. There were several huge laughs for me, but the Benjamin Button one was so weird. And yeah. And it was wrong. Like it was like a vague recollection of Benjamin Button's that he kind of presents, and then it's all kind of twisted and weird. And it was actually, I would have to say, for a visual effects sequence to serve the joke so specifically and do nothing else but service the joke, it struck me as fresh in that regard, because it really was a joke that made it work, and the visuals just had to, you know, be the rapper,
support it.
Right? The rapper.
I think he actually says, doesn't he actually say something like, I don't think I saw the film, or I can't remember what the film was like, or so some like literal remark about
yeah,
that?
Yeah, he kind of bumbles. He says it, he does a double. Like he says, I think what the line goes something like, I'm a baby that's getting old, or I'm an old man who's a baby. Like he doesn't articulate what the film was about precisely. And so the little fantasy moment is sort of a bastardization of the idea, but that's what makes it so funny to me. And again, I think it would have been, I think that the effects were beyond where they needed to be, because if they only would have been reasonable, I still would have been laughing. I'm not sure I was seeing the actual quality of the work because I was laughing. So, you know, to me, I guess I felt like that, the one thing I would say is globally, the work matched the needs of the scenes, to my mind anyway.
Yeah. MPC, I should have mentioned, was the house that did the skating sequence. Again, I find it very hard to be objective about that sequence, because I didn't want the character, especially in front of that boss guy, to drift off. So, you know, it kind of bothered me. And I just can't separate my reaction to the fact that you're right. It was so absurd. I don't know who did the Benjamin Button scene. I'm not quite sure. But the principal houses were Framestore, apart from MCC, Framestore, Soho, Hydraulics, Look, Hatch, Blind Squirrel, and Rhythm and Hughes, I believe, based on our article in FX Guide. But I think a better one for me was the Arctic stepping out of the billboard in the lobby or the coffee area inside the magazine. I mean, I thought that was a really nice piece of visual effects work, and it didn't bother me so much. That was, I think, Hydraulics that did that transition at the Life magazine cover to the room. Ty, do you agree with that? That was a pretty sort of well implemented, both gag and kind of visual effect sequence.
Yeah, I mean, again, it had a little bit of that that kind of, you know, what Irish Spring or one of these television commercials.
Old Spice.
The Old Spice, yeah. And it had that quality of, you know, the unexpected machismo masculine man showing up with, you know, all the attributes. But stylistically, I thought it was really well done, and it was striking in that regard. Actually, on that point, I think that the way that the film is set up, the way the director set it up, is that as we move into the more naturalistic kinds of effect sequences, and they're playing with that idea. I think he's consciously playing with that idea about, is this really real, or is this only a dream? You know, you have to kind of keep asking, because you don't want to be disappointed, so you're emotionally engaged on that level, that the naturalism starts to become part of the transition. And the transition narratively is one that is very seductive, I think, as an audience member, because at some point you start to see through Mitty's eyes, and especially in the skateboarding sequence, not to jump ahead, but you know, you really by that point are like wanting to be, instead of wanting to be a guy with superhero powers or, you know, these kind of crazy things, the guy who arrives from the, you know, with all the machismo and the masculine good looks, you actually want to be the man who's just enjoying the environment and the amazing beauty, and then this ride down a hill on a skateboard, which is very doable. Maybe not for me, but any longer. But it was more in the realm of what would be kind of human experience on a, you know, in a real world environment, as opposed to in an artificial environment. I thought that was very interesting structurally.
Jason, did you pick up on the fact that when they went into the fantasy sequences, it was shot anamorphically, and when it was in everyday life, it was shot spherically?
No. I thought the whole movie was anamorphic given a certain few sections, maybe because they cropped it.
But yeah, no, they adjusted their lensing depending on...
Interesting.
I picked up on the anamorphic, but again, I stopped noticing where that line was. I just thought they were mixing up their lenses. I didn't click that. And the other one was, of course, the saturation. It was much more heavily saturated in those.
Yeah.
But that was sort of a much more obvious clue.
Yeah, I definitely felt the anamorphic stuff. The reason I liked, just to back up for a second, the reason I liked that winter in the office, you know, billboard thing, is because in a lot of the other ones, he left the location that his daydream started in. And in this case, he's standing right where he is standing, and he's watching himself, you know, as the macho winter guy talking to Kristen Wiig, and that's where she actually is in real space. So it had a good blend of obviously, you know, it's fake because he's, you know, it's a daydream, but it felt like, you know, it transitioned really nicely in and out of it, because it was taking place in the same environment where he was actually standing.
Yeah. Well, see, I think you and Ty have both caught on to something. This sort of like how they played with our sense of is it fantasy or not? Because when he goes over to Greenland, don't forget, there is text in the picture as much in the same way there was in the title sequence. The Soho VFX sequence, which is almost entirely CG from LaGuardia to landing in Greenland in, what, 10 seconds or whatever it is. But it does have this text in the picture. And so when he's going off to see, Sean O'Connell, the Sean Penn character, you know, it is very graphical. It is not realistic, and it is pretty saturated. And yet, you know, he did go to Greenland. So it's – or Iceland. Was it Iceland or Greenland first?
We went to Greenland first, I think.
And then to Iceland, right.
And then to Iceland. Even though it was all shot in Iceland, I believe.
So just going to, again, the visual effects, what do we think about the swimming with the sharks? It's not a porpoise.
Well, I thought that I thought that, again, you know, that the trajectory of the effects work was heading more from this fantastical kind of presentation to more and more real, more and more reality-based. And, you know, even though the situation was extreme and, you know, crazy because of the drunken helicopter pilot, who I thought was awesome, I especially want to get one of those beer boots to drink out of.
I drank out of one of those in Amarillo, Texas.
Oh, maybe you can track one down.
You weren't disappointed that the soundtrack didn't include his version of the Human League song version, the one that was actually on the soundtrack? Because he was a pretty mean singer, I've got to say. Okay, but he gets off the plane, had that terrific underwater shot, which was pretty much all CG, when he's goes deep, having jumped out of the helicopter kind of the wrong way, and then comes up and we have this shark attack, which was actually shot as a combination of live action water, as in not very threatening water, and then extended out around him and built up around him was the CG water that was much more, and also had the shark in it. And in fact, if you actually look, and there's a still on the FX Guide site, which is that shark sequence, if you know that there's an oval around him that's the original water, you can actually kind of see it, but I didn't pick it in the film. So it matched well in the film, but once I know it's there, I can see it.
I mean, I didn't know there was any CG water in there. I assumed it was a CG shark, but I didn't. The water was expertly done. I mean, I had no, there were no signs of any kind. That whole sequence seemed completely photographed to me when I saw it.
Yeah. So the water, if you've got a shot of him in the water, sort of calling out to the boat, then you've got, I'm going to say, you know, a sixth of the frame is him and the water around him is real and the rest of it's CG.
Right. Yeah. Gorgeous.
We knew the shark was probably CG.
Assumingly.
Assumingly. But yeah, I thought that sequence worked really well. It was a good solution because I think having someone in water properly always helps tremendously.
Of course.
And of course, you know, you're looking at him and you're laughing, and it's all being played out pretty well. And I'd say also that sequence right after it, when he does come off the bike that I referred to earlier, when he sees her face in the starlings or the birds or whatever it is, again, really nicely done. It was enough that I read her face, but not so much that it looked so ridiculous as to be, yeah. I mean, it was comically funny with the timing with the crash, but I thought it was well handled in terms of a sort of a particle animation.
It was. It was nice.
But the nicest thing came right after that for me is that terrific volumetric explosion of the volcano. I thought the plumes of dust and stuff from the volcano were absolutely first rate. I remember thinking at the time that was some really, really good work. And again, I'm have to check who that is. I'm pretty sure it was Soho VFX. You know what I'm talking about?
It was really
nice.
Yeah, super nice. And actually, during that scene, I was super focused on all that stuff and looking at it. And they're in the car, and right before the dust cloud hits them, Ben Stiller goes, "Holy shit!" And my kid leans over to me and he goes, whispers to me, "He just said shit." And I said, "It's okay. He's being a chased by a volcano. It totally is what you would say. Totally fine."
A little life lesson there.
It's okay to curse in the proper situation.
If you have a volcano erupting around you, it's okay.
Yes. Yeah,
I mean, totally I thought the fine. CG plane was pretty good as well. Obviously, that that Sean Penn's character is meant to be flying in, photographing the volcano on. But that plume, it was just really nice work. Anyone want to have a stab at the name of the volcano that erupted?
I actually had it on my phone the other day. It's like yike and a fennel or something like that. It's really hard.
Yike and a fork and Jorfin coal.
Yeah, the Icelandic language.
I apologize to anyone in Scandinavia
difficult.
Who's listening to this show. But my wife can actually speak Swedish. Would I'm sure be able to pronounce it, but I couldn't. But yeah, that was just a sweet sequence. You know that roller skating. When he's skateboarding down to the town. Really reinforced to me, you know, because the earlier sequence when they're effectively doing that in the city, I just had nothing emotionally. When he's doing it there, I'm completely, you know, in love with him for doing it and love the story at that point. And certainly my daughters who were teenagers thought that was an awesome sequence of him riding into town where they didn't comment at all about the Manhattan fake sequence. Obviously, they're both, a stunt rider in the second one, but you know what I mean? So it is funny, isn't it? When you get that emotional connection to the character, you know, the visual effects just play at such a completely different level.
Yeah, and you know, I think that just from a structural standpoint, again, I'm kind of hung up on that, I guess, the writing of it, that it was something from his past. You know, the character had achieved, as happens so often in so many people's lives, certain lines of development or certain potentialities we come in contact with in our youth, and then as we mature, we're either forced or we decide to set them aside, and they're kind of left as these unfinished aspects of ourselves. So when they first introduced the notion that Stiller was able to to use a skateboard, and he's showing his love interest's son, you know, how to do a trick, I thought, well, that's weird. How's that going to play? You know, like, I didn't really understand it because she kind of missed it and he was still good at it. But then over the course of the larger picture, it was not just a skill that he was able to utilize to get from point A to B in an interesting, beautiful way. But it also became, again, a manifestation of the simplicity of living in the moment and being, you know, fully evolved. And I think the more I looked at the film, that those kind of elements, story elements that were so pleasurable and made that sequence so memorable, were actually quite well woven and informative in the sense of what the human drama was.
And it was also nice that he then took the skateboard back. So it wasn't just a case of, oh, we're going to show you something that will be important in a couple of scenes time. There it's important and then it's gone. And you know the first scene's only there to set up the second. because the whole point of going to the house with the skateboard, you know, had a whole lot of extra levels to it, as did getting the toy and causing that to be in his bag so that he could trade it. That interconnection is always nice when it's less just a convenience with a setup and more of an actual story that someone thought through. So I do agree with you totally.
And the skateboard, when she comes back and sees the husband, who clearly we find out later is not in the picture, but plays it to him as he is a nice, like, end of second act, like, real, you know, hard end of second act downer. We got to figure out how to get our character back to zero, you know, the end of act three.
It still gets us really in act three, the video of him skateboarding with the present.
Right.
So it all connects through rather than, just being we're going to set this up so we can do a cool skateboard sequence down into the town. So the Himalayas itself, when he goes on his journey and gets hit in the face with bushes, which cracked me up, which I now think I'm trying to work out which company did that one. Let me just work that out. But I said Soho Effects was on the volcano stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I thought the Himalayas was really pretty good. The sequence we actually find Sean O'Connor, which, you know, did feel kind of a bit effects-y, maybe because it sort of lacked a wider shot or seeing past them, it sort of felt like a slight kind of setup. But that being said, and the suddenly having kids playing soccer within sort of reach of a shot of the things, but I could allow it. It's certainly him getting to that meeting point all felt super real and just spectacular photography. And there was a lot of matte painting and there was a lot of digital environments to get him through the Himalayas. And I thought that really, really played well. And I kind of forgave them for that one kind of conceit, I guess, of having Sean being able to take the photos on the right and go off and play soccer on the left.
Well, also because their dialogue was so good. Like, by the time they sat down and started talking, the things they were talking about were so germane to both of their characters that you know, that's the power of strong writing, is you can forgive some, you know, minor scenic issues or minor continuity things where the world gets compressed a little bit because what they're talking about is so well tied into the narrative and so well written.
So that was filmed in Iceland, and it's Look Effects, who I was trying to think of a second ago, who basically got the Nepalese, the kind of Himalayan stuff to the Icelandic. So it converted Iceland into Nepal effectively. Ty, what did you think?
I thought it was all great. Again, I agree with your point. I mean, it did, once he actually laid eyes on the Sean Penn character, it became so... I became aware of the camera, you know, like I really kind of saw it as like, and you know, when you have these thoughts when you've been around production, they're not healthy for good movie watching, where you're thinking, well, they probably had him for a day, you know, like I was thinking that, you know, they probably had limited, you know, Sean was only available for a few days, so they just, you know, set up this rock and did that whole sequence to make sure it was in the can and they had it what they wanted. But that said, by the time we got there, like Jason suggested, the dialogue, I was ready to hear what he had to say. And I was waiting to hear, and it played really well. I mean, he became the mystic guide, you know. And
Ty, don't you think he needed? And don't you think, Ty, that the visual effects set that up so well with the picture, the photograph that comes to life on the board, that played into that kind of mystic feel that set the Sean O'Connell's character up.
Yeah,
just I love that, just slowly coming to life and just looking $1 million. And I think the visual effects just helped really set the tone that then got played out or paid off once they were taking the photographs in the Himalayas.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that there was a mystic quality that his character, you know, was definitely in, you know, like that's the whole quest, right? Quest for the master. That little shot of the black and white photo, him beckoning him was another little kind of gem moment that I really responded to. And again, I think the casting, I mean, you know, Sean Penn can pull that off, you know, like he was ready to be that, you know, with very, you know, until he speaks, he's just this mythic, you know, dude. And you kind of buy it, I thought.
Yeah, I think the actual art department totally nailed it. That final photo that is the punchline of the film, you know, it was believably magnificent and believably appropriate.
Oh, yeah.
There was so much that art department gave that, you know, without it, you would have gone, yeah, well, it doesn't really feel like, you know, it's at the level of Life magazine. And I was actually thinking they'd never showed the final picture because they'd set it up to be such a pivotal thing. I thought they can't actually deliver on a picture that we, the audience, are going to think, yeah, yeah, that would be the sort of picture that you would go to this much fuss about.
Yeah, I felt the same way. In fact, when they went up to buy the magazine, I was, by that point, I was like, oh man, don't show me something that I'm going to be the last image for me to walk out of here with that I'm not happy with. And it, again, just as the quality, another example of the quality of the totality, the picture, it was perfect. It was the perfect picture.
I hadn't imagined it. And when the payoff came, it did pay off.
That's exactly right.
Totally. I can honestly say that is the one time that the J.J. Abrams mystery box worked.
Yeah.
To hold it that long. Because normally J.J. Abrams holds his secrets too long and then he blows it in almost every movie that he does, in my opinion. But this was that concept of this ultimate, the Grail image, and I almost teared up a little bit because I was like, holy crap, it's not only is it perfect, it says everything about the film, it's not over the top, it's classy, it's like, it's very genuine, it actually says something about our real world and craftsmanship and all that kind of thing. It like said like so many things at once without being overt and being really subtly perfect.
And the other really nice thing about it, getting back to that earlier point we were talking about with the skateboard, is it totally justified the fact that the Sean Penn character had been in touch with his mother, that they'd have connected, that, you know, like a whole lot of things that you're willing to say, oh yeah, well, you know, he came to town and he missed him. I just accepted that. But of course, to take that photo, you'd want to know, you know, where he was going, what his sort of schedule was. You would sort of, you know, if you were aware of this guy for years, maybe touch base and so it all played out, all interconnected really well. But if that picture hadn't delivered, the film would have been really hollow. And I thought it was just great. And it's got to be, you know, just spectacular art direction.
The camera work was really good there too. It was really, they dropped in this super shallow depth of field, wide open stuff between him and lensing, between him and Kristen Wiig at the end there. That was just gorgeous.
Yeah. Yeah. And thus ended a really feel good, you know, movie, right? It did leave you with a really good beat, even though of course, you know, the bad guys effectively won the day. You didn't care.
Well, they did, but not in principle, right?
Yeah.
Which is over the arc of the film. And like, honestly, I was really happy that my kid saw a movie like that because the message was super strong. And he actually has still not stopped talking about it. And while I was away in Sundance, he had my father-in-law take him to see it again. It was a very positive film without being like sappy or
preachy
or anything. It was like, just like, you know, live your life, don't think about it, you know, like go out and do it, which is a really good message, which can be given off or said very badly sometimes.
So just before we go, I do want to bring up one other scene that did have me rolling around laughing. I mean, really laughing, which was the TSA security camera X-ray sequence. And I wanted to bring it up because I think it was a really wonderful piece of editing to not set that up. They sort of really cut to it almost in progress, and then they cut out of it, you know, without a lot of sort of exposition of what had happened. You got it all. And I just thought it played hysterically funny. I mean, it was, you know, a daft kind of thing and you knew it not to be real, but by the same token, I thought it was really, really funny. Ty, do you enjoy it or not?
I like the this would be one case where I'd kind of forgotten about that until you just brought it up. And you know, it of course had you know, elements of what Total Recall or some of those science fiction things. And I thought it was a clever way to compress the story at that point, because they had to introduce the, you know, the guy from the dating service. And that was very funny. And he was a good character. Yeah. But yeah, it was kind of a little like a little slice of the earlier vaudeville just kind of used as a transition. So I thought it was fun. It was well done. I mean, but for me, it's sort of, I guess it kind of pulled me out a little bit at that point, and maybe that's why it wasn't. That's why I have a hard time remembering it. Probably just said, "Oh, okay, whatever," and moved on to the next part of the story.
Yeah. Well, we'd had. So, am I right in thinking that's after he's? When does that happen in the film? So he's not met Sean Pinion, right? This is the when he comes back from the first.
Is it from the first time or the last? I can't remember where in the.
He's got to find someone in Los Angeles who knows him, and then he drives with them. Back or something, right? I think it was
because he obviously goes overseas twice.
It was after he'd gotten back from the Himalayas, because then he meets the guy from the dating service and then tells him all the stuff he does, and he had the flute, right?
Anyway, it was obviously an isolated sequence, and but it was done well by the effects team that did it. I thought. You know, it told the story. It was effectively pantomime, and yet I got it all.
And it injected some of the. It sort of was like a callback to the original, sort of over the top nature of the visual effects and the humor in the beginning, because the movie had gotten a little more serious. You know, the tone was a little not super serious, but it had gotten a little more serious that things were now happening to him for real. He was in danger, you know, at times, and not. You know, for real. So this was sort of like just a little breath of humor, I think, to just lighten the load a little bit in preparation for him sitting with Patton Oswalt.
Yeah, yeah, and
well done. I mean, cartoony, but it sort of needed to be.
Yeah, we all know that you don't get a full X-ray to the bone from those machines, and all that you can fit three people in them. But yeah, just having that play out like that, and I just thought whoever was given that, again, it was just one of those isolated sequences that never appeared anywhere else in the film, but it played out well. I think the original one that you referenced from Total Recall, they actually sent human skeletons through an X-ray machine to get kind of the basis for that. This was obviously done, I presume, as a full 3D animation. With a X-ray shader, but yeah, no, I thought it was really fun. Pretty just as an isolated thing, it was just another one of those little nuggets that made it good.
You know, now that we've talked about it, it would be interesting. Not now, but that has become kind of a convention. Like, you know, the security camera that reveals some bit of action in X-ray form or in you know in like some kind of scanner form. It would be. Interesting to just because now that you mention it, I'm thinking of several other films that have that in it also. So it's interesting they took that convention and kind of used it in a much more like you used it for a transition and kind of used it to cap off the end sequence a little bit.
The only effect sequence that actually failed for me, and it's an odd one, you're not going to guess it, I'm sure. It's when he's in, I think, Iceland or Greenland, and he's down by the water. And he looks over at a mountain and a text message comes in from Hernando, which says, "Bearded guy firing me if he doesn't see you ASAP 911. And I swear I saw the film twice and I couldn't read that. And then I got a still, production still, that I got to see it off and I could actually read it. And I was like, okay, well, whoever did that, I'm sure it was good and integrated, but you need to see it to be able to read it. I don't know. Did you read that text? You know what I'm talking about? On the mountain.
I loved the concept of it, and now that you bring it up, I don't recall what it said. So maybe that's true.
Yeah, I couldn't get it. It was like, what? I couldn't read the text, and I knew that it was something, but it didn't play. And therefore, it was just it didn't do what it was meant to do.
I certainly didn't get what you just read.
Well, I'm reading it off the screen
that,
now, right?
No, I know, but I'm just saying. I certainly didn't read that. But I just like the concept so much that it sort of just was distract. I was distracted away from not being able to read it, which maybe was the point. I don't know.
I would hope not.
Yeah, but yeah, I don't recall what it said. I don't remember reading it.
You can be too clever. And the audience, and I was just turning around to people next to me going, what did it say? Huh? What did it say? Someone was a bearded guy frying me or something. And I was like, what? And I saw it twice. And so the second time I deliberately tried to read it. And I thought, well, if you can't read it when you know it's coming and you're looking at it, somebody needs to. But hey, that was the only shot that didn't work for me. Is there any shots that didn't work for you guys?
No, I mean, I'm a little bit of a broken record, but I think there was a lot of kind of harmony in the film. The film had a certain kind of harmonious, at least as a viewer, I had a kind of harmonious viewing experience. So I didn't feel distracted from the primary story or distracted in a way that jarred me. And I thought the work was, across the boards, it was at a level that kept the quality of the experience high. So,
Jason?
No, I would agree. I mean, outside of the visual effects, which again, maybe other than what you just brought up, which I hadn't even thought about, the readability of the text, the effect was done well outside of, obviously you should be able to read it, but I enjoyed the effects across the board. I don't really think there was anything that didn't work for me. I think the thing that stood out to me the most was the cinematography. I think it was very different than a lot of, studio films. And I think they really, I forget which studio it was, but they were very smart in allowing him to make like a more artistic style out of his lensing than just sort of just, standard blocking and just, whatever we were talking about before with mixing lenses and whatnot. That was one of the things that really stuck out to me was the cinematography.
Yeah, I agree. The cinematography was really good. This very graphical style that, the framing like played out in front of you. It didn't try too hard for a film, and it was Fox that distributed it. I'm pretty sure Fox was also the primary studio, but they, it's like that thing about not trying too hard while actually obviously doing a lot of hard work and heavy lifting. This is sort of the poster film for me of something that doesn't look like it's trying very hard and yet clearly has got a sensational attention to detail. I really hope it just goes gangbusters for them because I'd like to see more of this style of film. I don't need to see a sequel of this film, but if anyone can do a similar film, and also we should, I guess, give a shout out. There were some really good actors that clearly didn't have huge roles in this. I mean, Shirley MacLaine had a tiny role, but was terrific, as the mother.
Yeah, even Catherine Hahn, his sister, was, she's...
Yeah.
Everyone was very... Like, everyone serviced their part really well.
This is not a film that is a tentpole mega blockbuster. So this is a film that's in that category that a lot of people are concerned about in terms of viability, which is another reason why I really hope that that it does well. I'm not sure. Does anyone have a budget number on it?
90 mil.
Right. So it's getting up there, right? I actually thought it was a bit less than that.
It made 170 so far worldwide, but they probably spent another at least 50 marketing it, I would imagine, worldwide. So they're probably, just around the break-even mark, but it'll do well word of mouth, VOD and Blu-ray and all that stuff, I would think.
Yeah.
Did anyone else wonder how they got permission to use Life magazine? Like, just as an aside? I was like, it worked so well using Life magazine.
Yeah, that thought crossed my mind at some juncture in the course of the film, and I thought, I consciously remember thinking, don't think about it too hard, because I was starting to think, when did that magazine go out of business, or when did they stop making the print version? And I started to become distracted, and in my mind, that's another example of why it was successful, is because it was all plausible and the details ultimately didn't affect me. It was, it had its own like internal logic that didn't bother me.
When also the thing about that made it a slightly, I wouldn't use the word timeless, but it didn't make it feel like it was in the total present, because you had a print magazine going out of business that we all sort of knew in the back of our minds had already done that, right?
Right.
And the Icelandic volcano exploded in the past, you know, on that scale, right? I know it does it fairly regularly or at some point, but I think it was enough of these sort of just slightly in the past moments that made it, you know, took it off the edge of being, you know, is this happening right now? Like, when is this happening? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did look it up because I'm that much of a geek. And I thought it was funny that the website, life.com, existed only until January 2012. And then it became a photo channel, I think, for Getty Images or somebody after that. But I just couldn't resist actually looking it up. And so clearly the magazine isn't published anymore. And it, you know, it stopped being published, then it came back. But I thought it was even funny that the website was no longer, you know, existing as had been portrayed in the film, which was. But look, you know, I guess Time owns it. Whoever owns it, there is still obviously a website. If you hit
Time Life,
yeah,
but, it used to be Time Life before it was Time Warner.
Yeah, and life.time.com still exists, showing a lot of the great imagery that made the thing great in the first place. But it was terrific that they went to the trouble of doing that. And I guess they could have come up with another thing that sounded like Life that would have had most of the same thing, but it gave it a real gravitas to actually use Life magazine. And
Well, that was for us older folks, because I would guarantee you that half the audience didn't know Life magazine was ever actually real.
Right. And yet, don't you think that end photo was so beautiful, typically Life?
Perfect for Life magazine.
Yeah.
I mean, I have two Life magazines here, original Life magazines in my house. One is the original Jackson Pollock interview that they show in the film, that when he gets the article, and one's his obituary.
Wow. The Jackson Pollock article, the original one's from the 40s, right?
Yeah, yeah, they're old. They're original, old, original vintage lives.
Okay, well, thank you so much, guys, for taking us down your point of view on the film. I really enjoyed this film. I really enjoyed talking to you guys today. I guess I just want to give an opportunity for where people can sort of touch base with you. Ty, we started at the beginning of the show by mentioning that you were over in Richmond. Do you want to maybe set up where somebody could contact you or follow you or stalk you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I'm always available through my website, alieninsect.com, and I'm actually becoming... I'm very active on Facebook. So if you just search Ty Rubin, I've got a great string of people across the world that provide me with more information per day than I can possibly read on topics that I actually care a great deal about. So I'm able to, you know, set aside the cat photos and glasses of wine sitting next to people in bars and dig in on some great connections to research and stories that are relevant to my life. So yeah,
as we spoke I clicked on send a friend request on Facebook, though apparently the kids today are off Facebook, but there you go.
Yeah, but that's all right, you know, it still works for me.
What about you, Jason?
Same, my website that I have with my brother, thediamondbros.com, and on the Twitters, Jason Diamond, one word.
Just well, I've got you. Did you sort of, was there anything that struck you in terms of Sundance that was a theme or sort of a impression that you got overall of this year's Sundance?
A lot of Alexa movies, a lot of film movies, and a lot of movies that have musical themes. The movie that won both the Audience Award and the Jury Award, Whiplash, which was incredible and deserved every accolade it got, including the sale it got the second day into the festival, is about a kid in like a Juilliard type music school in the like top notch jazz band as a drummer. And they're just constantly talking about Buddy Rich and Charlie Parker. And I feel like to have, plus the kid who wrote and directed is 28, and to have like a movie about jazz drumming be the high point of the festival and have everyone respond to it that way was not only a surprise to me, but like I welcomed it because that's something I'm very passionate about, music in general, but especially jazz and stuff like that. And it's just really well done. And so I think that was maybe my biggest surprise.
Hmm. You mentioned a lot of ARRI productions. Did you see that obviously ARRI Cam was used on this one? They were shooting a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But did you see that somebody posted that every film nominated for Best Picture and for Cinematography in the Oscars this year was in fact shot on an Alexa or an ARRI Cam?
Yeah, I mean, last year at least half of them were Red, including Fincher, and you know, you could look at the Golden Globes, and Golden Globes probably has a lot more Red, including House of Cards and other things like that. I mean, you know, the Red Alexa thing has become so ubiquitous now that you could probably just take a handful of movies and throw them up in the air, and at any given time you'd come up with a stack deck on either side.
Well, it's interesting you say that, as if it's a Red versus Alexa thing. Because,
well, it's not, but I'm just
going to say there's no Canon cameras, there's no Sony, there's just
ARRI. Except for Rush. Rush, I guess, was
not in cinematography or Best Picture.
Oh, okay, but I mean, I'm not making it that way. But that's to me when I happen to see that someone post that on Red User, which clearly is intimating that sort of versus aspect. I personally don't care. As long as the movie looks good, you know, like Rush, for example, when we talked about it, is like 14 different kinds of camera and it looked great, versus, you know, a movie shot on film like this one, or, you know, Prometheus shot on Red or what have you. I think, you know, good people with, you know, can use good tools to make, you know, their work look good.
Speaking of awards, this film, Secret Life of Walter Mitty, is in the Outstanding Supporting Visual Effects in a Feature Film or Motion Picture category of the annual VES Awards. So this is sort of like the visual effects supporting a film but not being, you know, mainly an effects film. And it's up against Rush and Great Gatsby, Lone Ranger, Wolf of Wall Street, and White House Down, which is an interesting category, I think, because...
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Interestingly, I think because Lone Ranger has been, you know, singled out at the Oscar level as a primary nominee, as opposed to here where it's listed under this category of sort of supporting the visual effects rather than that are leading as visual effects. Gatsby as well, you know, a really beautifully shot film and well done. But Stereo is so epic because it seems like Epic has such a great role in Stereo captured films. But yeah, I'm interested to see what happens in this category. Have you guys seen Wolf of Wall Street, by the way?
I have not yet.
I have not either, but it's one of those films where I've been asked that like by three or four people a day, it seems like, for the last week, and I definitely am going to make a point to get out and check it. So
I actually find this category in the VES Awards one of the more interesting ones, this and the character animation categories. I guess because, you know, we kind of often focus on the Oscars, and so that tends to be the big tent poles, which at the moment tends to be sort of the superhero films, where you get these other interesting films in this sort of supporting visual effects category. And I think Rush is another really, really interesting film. So, yeah, I'd say all of those films, probably maybe slightly less White House Down, you know, films that have tremendously interesting cinematic and visual effects properties. So I was glad to see the multiple houses from Walter Mitty nominated in this area. And, you know, full credit to the VFX supervisor and Walter Mitty, a standing job keeping these consistent, given they were so vastly different in their need, look, execution, and just general style. So that's it for this week. I just want to say thank you so much, guys, for listening. We had a bit of a break over the Christmas period because it's in Australia, it's summer, and so I went on holidays and I wasn't even here. But you guys have been great in sending me emails and kicking me in the butt and saying, why haven't you had a VFX show out? So thank you for that. If you want to send any other messages, always post on the comment section over at fxguide.com. We do like to hear from you. If you put your email there, we'll probably respond in person. Thanks so much for being with us. And until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.